Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a population that stands right on the front lines of recovery, but is so often just completely overlooked.
And unprotected.
Totally unprotected. We're talking about the spouses, the partners, and the primary caregivers of combat veterans.
We often call them the invisible infantry. It's a fitting term because they absorb so much of the collateral damage of war. They're wrestling constantly with the psychological, sometimes physical, toll of supporting a loved one with really severe service-connected disabilities.
And that exposure, it often leads to this intense secondary trauma.
Right.
And far too often, it puts them directly in harm's way.
Right, as victims of intimate partner violence.
It's a truly devastating cycle. And when a caregiver finally hits that breaking point where they have to seek safety, they have to separate the system, I mean, it often just abandons them.
It's worse than abandonment in some cases. It actively pushes them towards financial ruin.
So that's our mission today. We are going to unpack the specialized blueprint for a revolutionary kind of solution. It's called the Reclaimed Sanctum of the Rising. We'll just call it the Sanctum.
And this is a really deep dive into what's essentially a specialized humanitarian refuge. The blueprint is unique because it's not just one thing. It integrates clinical strategy, legal strategy, and even architectural strategies. They're all designed to work together.
For what, a twofold goal?
Exactly. First, to treat the severe psychological trauma, the secondary PTSD we mentioned. But second, and this is crucial, it's about building a robust defense against what is basically an institutionally mandated financial collapse.
And that's what these caregivers face when they file for divorce, especially in states with really restrictive, almost punitive laws like Wyoming.
Right. So we're going to tackle this in a few parts. First, the way. The humanitarian imperative for the sanctuary, then the how, the actual design, both therapeutic and architectural.
And then, and this is maybe the most critical piece, we'll get into the systemic barriers, the legal and financial traps that create that, what happens if we don't do this scenario?
To really get why the sanctum is so necessary, we have to start with the dual burden that these caregivers are shouldering. They're dealing with a profound psychological injury just from being close to severe trauma. It has a name, secondary post-traumatic stress disorder. It stems directly from that continuous exposure to the veteran's disability.
And that could be physical, it could be neurological.
Anything. And that exposure means they are living in a state of constant hypervigilance, just always ready for the next outburst, the next flashback, the next crisis.
That sounds absolutely exhausting. I mean, chronic emotional exhaustion. You're absorbing all of that stress.
And as the sources we looked at show, this trauma is so often compounded by intimate partner violence and, very commonly, severe financial abuse.
Okay, let's define that, because financial abuse isn't just a side effect, is it? It's a tactic.
It is the deliberate mechanism of control. It's how the victim is trapped. We have to be clear about what it is. It's the veteran controlling all the money, withholding funds, stealing marital property or credit, hiding bank accounts.
Or even actively sabotaging the spouse's job, preventing them from working.
Exactly. That control becomes a cage.
And the economic fallout from that is, I imagine, immediate and terrifying.
It's a primary driver of housing insecurity. Of destitution. The data we have shows that as many as half of all homeless women who've experienced IPV intimate partner violence, they lost their jobs or were forced out of the workforce.
Either because of the violence itself or because of those coercive control tactics you mentioned.
And when you lose your career, you lose your financial independence. So the moment that caregiver tries to get control back, tries to separate the system, especially in certain states, it delivers the knockout blow.
Which brings us to this idea of the systemic financial cliff.
Yeah.
A guaranteed path to poverty that's actually, you know, written into state law. And we're looking at Wyoming as the pilot location here.
Yes, specifically Wyoming Statute 22114. This is a huge piece of the puzzle the sanctum is trying to solve.
Okay, so break that down for us. What does the statute actually do?
Well, it's in the property disposition section of their divorce law. And first, it says something that's pretty standard. It says courts can't consider federal VA disability benefits when they're dividing up marital property.
Right, that's based on federal law. The benefits are considered the veteran's separate property. That's true everywhere.
It is. That part is standard. But here's where the Wyoming law becomes so uniquely devastating.
The indemnification part.
The prohibition against indemnification. The statute explicitly says that a court cannot, under any circumstances, compensate or, and you know, indemnify a former spouse for any reduction in their share of military retirement pay if that reduction happens because the veteran chooses to maximize their VA disability benefits.
Okay, let's make that real for people.
Yeah.
Let's say a couple is counting on a military retirement pension, 20 years of service, and the court says the spouse's share is, say, $1,500 a month.
A very typical scenario.
The divorce is final. Then, after the fact, the veteran decides to waive $1,500 of that taxable retirement income to get more of his non-taxable VA disability pay.
It's a smart financial move for the veteran.
But for the former spouse?
The loss is immediate and total. Their expected $1,500 property share is gone, and the Wyoming court is legally forbidden from doing anything about it. They can't adjust other assets to make up for it. Nothing.
So seeking a divorce in Wyoming means you are facing a structured, systematic financial cliff. The law prevents the court from reclaiming what was, for all intents and purposes, a marital asset.
And the caregiver spouse, who probably sacrificed their own career for years, is left with nothing but crippling financial insecurity.
That's the core legal trauma here. It's abuse that is then validated and compounded by the legal system itself.
Precisely. And that institutional failure is what informs the entire ethos of the sanctum.
So this isn't just some academic theory.
Not at all. It's born from lived experience. It's a survivor-led idea. The caregivers themselves realized that the existing systems, you know, including the VA's approach to these issues, they just weren't working. They were often told their pain was just an expected consequence of military service.
Wow. Expected.
So the sanctum becomes this powerful statement. It's saying that to heal from this kind of trauma, you need complete safety, you need total sovereignty, and most importantly, you need a system designed by the people who actually understand the mechanics of control and financial ruin that were used against them.
It's about giving that invisible infantry the tools not just to survive, but to actually reclaim their independence, financial, physical, and emotional.
In an environment that's built from the ground up for their very specific, very complex needs.
Okay, so once you establish that absolute need for specialized care for financial protection, the next question has to be, how do you actually build it? How do you create an environment that can facilitate that kind of profound healing?
Well, the blueprint details this really integrated, evidence-based strategy, and it all starts with the clinical model.
And that model is rooted in something called therapeutic ecology.
Right. It's an approach that sees the environment itself as a critical part of the intervention. They've specifically chosen a model called green care, which is implemented through care farming.
And that's integrated with a hybrid off-grid self-reliance model.
Exactly.
Let's define care farming. I mean, it sounds nice, but how is it clinically effective for someone dealing with severe trauma?
So care farming isn't just about planting a garden. It's the structured, purposeful engagement in farming, animal husbandry, horticulture, all for therapeutic benefit.
And there's data on this.
There is. The empirical efficacy is really compelling. It leads to significant, measurable reductions in subjective distress and grief intensity for trauma survivors. Mm-hmm. And it's often preferred because it's a non-medical model of care.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, for a lot of trauma survivors, especially if they're dealing with traumatic grief, just relying on medication, there isn't always a consensus on that. And there can be side effects they want to avoid.
Right.
Working with living things, plants, animals, it provides this consistent, non-judgmental relationship that can help foster emotional stability in a way that medication sometimes can't.
So that hands-on work becomes a way to regulate your own nervous system, to shift your focus away from, you know, the internal storm.
That's a great way to put it. And that's where the hybrid off-grid self-reliance model comes in. It's not just about being sustainable. It's therapy. It's a deliberate therapeutic tool. It's designed specifically to counteract the effects of the intimate partner violence they've experienced.
Which is all about control and helplessness.
Exactly. This self-reliance model demands hard physical work. You're tending the gardens, you're managing the livestock, you're carrying wood for the stove, you're monitoring the solar batteries.
That physical work restores a sense of agency.
Precisely. The labor forces you to rely on your own capability. You are literally producing your own heat, your own food, your own power. And that intentional act of building competence, of building resourcefulness, it directly counteracts those feelings of control and helplessness that the abuser instilled. It builds what the blueprint calls foundational grit and resolve.
And to support that process, the plan outlines some really specialized communal infrastructure. Things that will be centralized in a community gathering hall.
Yes, a few key components. First is the commercial kitchen and communal dining facility.
Which is about more than just food.
So much more. Shared meals are a core component of trauma recovery because they fight against that profound social isolation that almost always comes with depression and surviving abuse. You're fostering emotional connection in a safe space. And as a bonus, the commercial setup doubles as a vocational training space.
So they can gain marketable skills, food prep, catering.
Exactly.
And the costs reflect that. I mean, it's a serious investment. $40,000 to maybe over $200,000 for high-end commercial gear.
It's a necessary foundational CapEx, a capital expenditure. The second piece of specified infrastructure is for wellness, an infrared sauna.
Okay, that might sound like a luxury to some people, but you're saying it serves a critical clinical function.
It does. For a trauma survivor, the nervous system is often just locked in a state of hyperarousal.
Right.
That fight or flight response is always on.
Right.
Controlled heat exposure, like in a sauna, helps manage that. It triggers the release of endorphins, which helps with mood. But more importantly, it forces the nervous system to shift its focus to thermoregulation, to cooling the body down. And that gently helps calm that autonomic stress response.
And why infrared specifically?
It's about deeper therapeutic heat penetration, but at lower ambient temperatures. That makes the whole experience less intense, less claustrophobic, which is really important for someone who's dealing with high anxiety or sensory triggers from their PTSD.
So you get the significant therapeutic benefit, and the cost for a community-sized unit between $3,500 and $10,000 makes it a really cost-effective intervention.
Ah.
But none of this healing can happen if the environment itself doesn't feel fundamentally safe, resilient.
That's the crucial link. Physical safety is psychological safety. And the architecture has to respond to that. First, it has to handle the severe Wyoming climate.
The Wyoming climate challenge. We're talking winter temps below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, high winds.
And you need extreme energy efficiency to keep your operating expenses, your OPEX, low enough to be sustainable. But beyond the climate, the feeling of safety and stability is just non-negotiable for a trauma survivor.
They need a building that actively minimizes triggers, which led to this detailed comparative analysis of how to actually build the place.
Right. They looked at three main paths. The first was prefabricated or modular housing for the individual living units.
And the benefits there are pretty clear.
Very clear. Predictable cost, it's fast, and the quality control is high because they're built in a factory. Modular also tends to have better insulation, better R values, and the projections show it could cut maintenance costs by about 14% over 10 years.
But the downside is the turnkey cost is high, 3 to 5 times the material cost.
Right, so maybe not the best for a large central building.
So the second option they looked at was earth integrated or earth bag construction. Very sustainable.
The sustainable ideal, yeah. And on paper, it has the lowest theoretical material CapEx, maybe as low as $16 a square foot. It also provides excellent natural insulation, but...
But the blueprint flags this as an unacceptably high risk for a pilot project.
An unacceptably high risk?
Nah.
The labor. It relies on highly specialized or volunteer labor, which is incredibly difficult to coordinate and quality control in a rural place like Wyoming.
That volatility leads to delays, cost overruns,
and potential structural failure, which is just not an option for a trauma sanctuary. I mean, you're already looking at baseline utility costs of $13,000 to $32,000 just for a well and septic system. You can't add that kind of construction risk on top.
So they landed on the optimal choice, the ICF hybrid recommendation, centered on insulated concrete forms.
ICF. It's the smart, resilient, long-term solution, especially for that main community gathering hall.
Explain what ICF is.
The blocks are essentially permanent forms. They're these high-density foam panels, and you pour concrete and rebar into them. When it cures, you have a structure that performs light years beyond a standard stick-built building.
And let's get specific. Why is ICF uniquely therapeutic for this population?
Two big reasons. First, superior soundproofing.
Ah.
A standard house has pretty poor sound dampening. For someone with hyperarousal, an unexpected loud noise, a truck going by, a door slamming, a big gust of wind, that can be a powerful trigger. It can set off a panic attack or a flashback instantly. ICF walls provide this massive noise reduction. It's a thick, quiet, protective buffer.
Creating a calm space.
A calm, predictable space. And the second reason is resilience and energy efficiency, which goes back to keeping OPEX low. ICF gives you vastly superior R values. We're talking R40 to R50 compared to, you know, R13 in a standard wall. That means lower energy bills, which is critical for the long-term sustainability of the nonprofit. And on top of that, it's incredibly resistant to high winds and fire, which reinforces that psychological feeling of absolute safety and permanence that abuse survivors so desperately need.
So the hybrid approach really marries the best of both worlds. The central community hub gets the resilience and the sound dampening of ICF.
And the individual homes get the cost control and predictability of highly insulated modular units.
It's a design where every single dollar spent on the structure directly contributes to the therapeutic outcome. So we've laid out the intense clinical need and the architectural answer, but now we have to get into what is probably the most complicated part of this blueprint, the legal strategy. It's what's needed to shield these caregivers from that guaranteed financial devastation they face the minute they leave.
Right. This part of the deep dive really explains why the Sanctum has to include aggressive legal empowerment as a core service.
And this whole challenge is rooted in a complex clash between state family law and federal preemption.
That's the starting point, the federal preemption framework. Specifically, a law called the Uniformed Services Former Spouses Protection Act, or USFSPA, and a key Supreme Court ruling in a case called Mansell v. Mansell.
What did Mansell establish definitively?
Mansell confirmed the rule that VA disability benefits, what are called Title 38 benefits, cannot be treated as marital property that a state court can divide up.
So the benefit belongs solely to the veteran.
Solely to the veteran. It doesn't matter when the disability happened or when the benefits were awarded. This federal preemption is non-negotiable. States like Wyoming, Arizona, they all align their statutes with this. The caregiver or spouse cannot touch that VA disability payment as a marital asset. Period.
Okay, so that's the first hammer. You lose access to that income as property. But then there's the second hammer, the Howell trap.
The Howell v. Howell ruling from 2017 finalized what we call the indemnification trap. This happens when a veteran is getting both military retirement pay, which is divisible as marital property, and VA disability pay.
And the VA pay is non-taxable while the retirement pay is taxed.
Exactly. So the veteran has a huge financial incentive to waive their taxable retirement pay in order to maximize their non-taxable VA disability income.
So let's go back to our example. The divorce is final. The court awards the former spouse $1,500 a month from the veteran's retirement pay as part of the property settlement.
Right.
A few months later, the veteran files a waiver, shifting, say, $2,500 of his taxable retirement pay over to his non-taxable VA disability pay.
And the result for the former spouse is immediate. The court ordered $1,500 they were counting on is suddenly reduced. It could even be reduced to zero.
Because the veteran unilaterally shrank the pot of divisible assets.
And here's the trap. The Supreme Court in Howell ruled that state courts are preempted from ordering the veteran to compensate or indemnify the former spouse for that loss. In essence, the veteran can, after the divorce, just unilaterally undo a part of the property settlement.
And Wyoming statute 22-114B explicitly mirrors that prohibition. The financial loss is guaranteed and it's permanent.
It sounds like a total dead end. But the Sanctum's blueprint, it hinges on this critical legal pivot point, something established decades earlier in a case called Rose v. Rose in 1987.
And this is the distinction between property and support.
This is the entire foundation of the legal counter-strategy. While Mansell says you can't divide VA benefits as property, Rose v. Rose established that those exact same VA benefits can and must be considered as income when you're calculating financial support.
Meaning spousal support, alimony, and child support.
Exactly. The Supreme Court's reasoning was that the intent of Congress with VA payments was to support not just the veteran as an individual, but the veteran and their family.
So the legal team for the Sanctum can't get the VA benefits as property, but they have to pivot and maximize the support payments using those same benefits as calculable income.
That's the play. And this is where we see the state-level conflicts that actively block that path and threaten to make these caregivers destitute.
Let's look at that legal landscape. We've got what the blueprint calls Wyoming's ambiguity and Arizona's explicit bar.
Starting with Wyoming, their statute, WS 22-114, says courts can't consider VA benefits. And that word is the problem.
Can't that just be interpreted broadly to completely gut the Rose Doctrine?
That is the ambiguity, and that is the threat. Remember that prohibition is in the subsection of the law that governs property disposition. So a narrow, correct reading would suggest the prohibition only applies to dividing assets, meaning VA benefits can still be considered as income for support calculations.
Which would align with Rose, and that's the interpretation the Sanctum's legal aid has to fight for.
It's the only way. But if a Wyoming court takes a broad reading and says we can't even look at VA benefits for any purpose,
the caregiver is financially destroyed, especially if the VA benefit is the veteran's main source of income.
It is. If that primary income stream is legally invisible to the support calculation, the caregiver, who probably has a very limited earning capacity after years out of the workforce, gets little or no alimony. It completely defeats the purpose of spousal support.
And while Wyoming has this ambiguity, the blueprint points out that Arizona has gone a step further. They've basically codified a direct attack on Roe v. Roe.
Arizona Revised Statute Section 25530 is a direct legislative contradiction to federal intent. It explicitly prohibits their state courts from considering VA disability benefits when they are determining the award or the amount of spousal maintenance.
So there's no ambiguity there. Arizona law just makes VA income totally invisible for alimony.
Correct. Which means a caregiver spouse separating in Arizona is almost guaranteed to face financial devastation, even if the veteran is earning a very significant income from those benefits.
The financial impact is what? Catastrophic?
Immediate and catastrophic. The caregiver is left with no transitional support. They're pushed immediately toward public assistance, housing insecurity. It is the definition of institutionalized financial ruin.
So the legal team for the Sanctum, they can't be general family lawyer.
Yeah. They have to have strategic legal countermeasures that are specifically designed to navigate these very complex federal-state conflicts. Their operational model demands robust, hyper-specialized legal aid.
And they have to focus aggressively on leveraging Roe v. Roe in every single case.
Which is why the blueprint calls for formal partnerships with specialized pro bono legal clinics. They mention places like Creighton University, the University of Nebraska College of Law. These are not fights for general practitioners.
No, you need experts to challenge the ambiguity in Wyoming's law, and maybe even challenge the constitutionality of Arizona's law.
Absolutely. And because physical safety is so immediate, the legal strategy has to be paired with money to escape. The blueprint requires an emergency relocation assistance reserve.
Budgeted for up to $3,000 per family.
Right. And that reserve ensures they can get into the program safely and immediately. It addresses the instant threat of homelessness that financial abuse creates.
So the Sanctum isn't just a physical refuge. It's a financial and legal fortress designed to fight back against state laws that systematically punish survivors.
So making this whole thing a reality, moving from the blueprint to an actual place,
right,
that requires a very clear-eyed look at the costs, the risks, and the sustainability model.
Let's start with the capital expenditure, the CapEx snapshot. The total estimated cost for the pilot is substantial. It ranges from about $507,000 up to almost $1 million.
It's a huge fundraising lift, and that range really highlights the risks. I mean, just look at the foundational investments. Utility infrastructure, drilling a well, putting in a septic system in rural Wyoming, that alone is between $13,000 and $32,000, and those costs can be really volatile depending on the land.
And the community gathering hall, using that superior ICF model, is estimated $90,000 to $130,000 just for the shell, not even the inside.
Exactly. But the key investment for long-term sustainability is that hybrid off-grid power system.
Right. The solar panels, maybe a small wind turbine, battery backup, estimated at $30,000 to $60,000. Why is that so critical?
It minimizes their vulnerability on the OPEX side. In a cold, rural climate, utility bills can bankrupt a nonprofit. By being mostly energy self-reliant, they are hedging against future price shocks. It guarantees a predictable and low operational cost for heat and power, which is just essential for the organization to survive long term.
And beyond the buildings, you need people. Specialized staffing for specialized care. And attracting that kind of clinical talent to rural Wyoming must be a huge operational challenge.
It is. And it demands competitive pay. The blueprint is very realistic about this. They know they have to target the 75th percentile of market rates just to attract and retain the kind of talent they need.
Can you give us some examples of those salaries?
Sure. An executive director for a project this complex would need a salary in the range of, say, $75,000 to almost $89,000. A licensed clinical psychologist, someone who's dealing with severe, complex trauma, their salary averages between $74,000 and over $100,000.
If they tried to offer less, they'd just compromise the quality of care.
Which is not an option for this population, but their strategy for 2147 crisis support is actually quite fiscally responsible.
How so?
Instead of hiring multiple full-time salaried crisis staff, which would come with massive overhead and benefits packages, they plan to use contract clinical psychologists. They've budgeted competitive hourly rates around $51 to $81 an hour.
So they can maintain a large bank of available clinical hours without the fixed costs. That's smart.
It gives them flexibility while guaranteeing they have rapid response capability.
But the ultimate goal isn't just to shelter residents, it's to equip them for financial independence. Which brings us to the vocational training.
Right, the pathways to self-sufficiency. And the training programs are very deliberately chosen. They're practical, they're relevant to the therapeutic model, and they're about overcoming that financial instability.
One key area is animal husbandry and fiber arts.
Yes. They propose using animals like alpacas, which serve this amazing dual purpose. They provide a huge therapeutic benefit. They're gentle, calming animals to be around. But they also generate a micro-enterprise revenue stream.
How does that work financially?
Well, you process the fiber, the fleece, into yarn or roving. That costs about $15 to $25 a pound to process, and it creates a viable, high-margin product that can be sold. So residents are earning revenue while they're learning a marketable skill in a low-stress environment.
They also plan to teach carpentry and construction, which is obviously a high-demand trade, and also self-defense training.
And that goes right back to the psychological need. Self-defense training isn't just a practical skill. It's a critical psychological intervention. It restores a sense of personal agency and physical security. It directly confronts and reverses that feeling of powerlessness that IPV creates.
But the blueprint identifies one massive operational barrier that could undermine all of the success.
Childcare. It's a huge structural challenge, especially in rural Wyoming. The lack of affordable, high-quality childcare is explicitly cited as a factor that keeps thousands of people, mostly single mothers, out of the workforce there.
So if a resident can't find care for her kids, she can't go to training, she can't get a job, the whole vocational program becomes useless.
Exactly. So the Sanctum has to treat childcare as an aggressive funding priority. They have to pursue state and federal grants, partner with programs like Head Start. They have to eliminate that single greatest barrier to financial self-sufficiency.
And finally, we circle back to long-term resilience. The physical choices, the ICF architecture, the renewable energy, those are the anchors of sustainability.
They minimize the organization's vulnerability to the outside economy. They drive down OPEX year after year.
But that sustainability isn't zero cost. They still have to budget for maintenance.
That's right. You have to have a dedicated, protected annual maintenance reserve. A building is only resilient if you have the funds to keep it that way.
And lastly, this vision, the Sanctum. It requires a call for help that goes way beyond just money.
The blueprint is very clear about the tangible needs. They need expertise. They need tradespeople, fencing experts, permaculture specialists. They need material goods, wood stoves, building materials, ideally a land donation with trees and a water source. Mm. And of course, therapeutic animal companions.
The success of this really hinges on the whole community recognizing that they're part of the healing process for this invisible inventory. So this deep dive has really shown us that the reclaimed Sanctum of the Rising, it isn't just a humanitarian idea. It's a direct, necessary response to systemic failures, failures that actively punish the caregivers of our veterans.
The why is that devastating combination of secondary trauma and this institutionally mandated financial exclusion.
And its success will be measured by how well it integrates its model. Mm-hmm. It has to combine the restorative power of that therapeutic green care
with an aggressive, specialized legal strategy. That pivot from unrecoverable property to maximizing support by leveraging the Rose v. Rose doctrine, that is the single most critical factor that will determine whether these survivors can actually achieve financial sovereignty.
And the ultimate implication of this whole legal blueprint, especially when you look at it next to a state law like Arizona's ARS Section 25530, it's staggering.
It really is. When a state legislature explicitly prohibits its own courts from even considering an income source, the VA benefits that the U.S. Supreme Court has already confirmed are intended by Congress for the benefit of the veteran's whole family. Well, that creates a direct constitutional conflict. It's called obstacle preemption.
The state law is literally standing as an obstacle to the intent of federal law.
Which raises this profound and vital question that has to be resolved, either in court or through new legislation. Should any state be allowed to create a law that prioritizes shielding a veteran's isolated income stream over the basic financial needs of the dependents he was legally and morally obligated to support?
It's a conflict that, for the members of this invisible infantry, is literally the difference between destitution and reclaiming a safe future.
We'd encourage you to continue exploring this really delicate legal balance between state autonomy and family law and the welfare of those who care for our wounded warriors. Thank you for diving deep with us today.